Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline. Today, joined by Dr. Asia Lifridge from right here in D.C., so local with George Washington. Didn't have to travel far, and so we were actually talking about the snowstorm that's coming, and so she's the lucky one that doesn't have to worry about significantly about travel being so close. But we're talking with her. She's taking on a leadership role here with ASEP, with the diversity, inclusion, and one thing we want to talk about today, I want to talk about all of that, but the cultural bias project with ASEP. And so I think it's a really interesting topic, something that Dr. Parker has really been driving, and we actually talked to her this morning and other interviews we've had with her about her drive towards diversity and inclusion, and it really gets into some deep stuff and some stuff that we probably haven't thought about in emergency medicine. So I appreciate you coming on and talking with us, and give us a little background on yourself.
Well, thanks so much, Ryan. It's really nice to be with you here today. So I am Asia Lifridge out of George Washington University here, where I practice, and I'm also the fellowship director for health policy at George Washington. And so it really has been a pleasure to serve the college in the capacity of chairing the Diversity and Inclusion Task Force. And under that umbrella, of course, there have been several initiatives that we've put forward in order to do some introspection, essentially, as a college and as a specialty around the topic of diversity and inclusion, and just understanding how terribly vital it is to be a diverse specialty in terms of workforce and in terms of taking care of the patients that we serve in a quality manner.
What are some of the biggest challenges we're going to face? And I'm sure you understand and you've seen through your practice some of these challenges, but getting into this in terms of a formal role, what are the challenges that you realize that have always been there, and the new challenges that were uncovered when we started getting into this adventure with ASEP this year?
Well, that's a great question. I think first and foremost, awareness is going to be the cornerstone of any type of progress that we're able to make. And so it's going to first behoove us to become aware of what the issues are around this topic and to approach it from a very, humble standpoint. I think also a big challenge is to understand that issues around diversity and implicit bias and cultural competence are ubiquitous. These are issues that we all essentially face and deal with every day in our lives, and they're not necessarily negative things. They are just a part of our culture. They are inherently become a part of who we are just by virtue of being alive and interacting with culture and having various exposures. And so I think a big challenge is to first become aware of what the issues are around this topic, and also to be able to approach it from a standpoint that's not defensive, understanding that we're all very good people. I believe that, and we all want what's best for our patients.
It's a simple fact in emergency medicine, especially, that though med schools are basically 50-50, actually leaning more towards the female side, but emergency medicine is traditionally and still overwhelmingly Caucasian male. And I think there's some challenges from that population understanding what challenges and things other people face in emergency medicine or medicine in general. It's Norman Rockwell, and everybody that's ever painted a physician tends to paint that gray-haired white male, glasses. That picture hanging on the wall of the Norman Rockwell's physician taking care of a child. What are the help us understand? Help that Caucasian male physician understand some of the things that we don't see or understand on a daily basis.
Sure. So you're absolutely right, Ryan. In fact, in ASEP, only about 25% of our members are female. Only about 8% of our department chairs are of a minority race or ethnicity. And even in terms of our counselors, under 5% tend to be of a minority race or ethnicity. And what we know is that those numbers certainly do not reflect the general population in terms of its diversity. And further, outside of having diversity just for the sake of diversity, what we have to understand is that diversity enhances what we do. To have a uniqueness about us with a makeup that is unique and represents all walks of life brings a lot of really helpful information and energy to the table as we do this important work as a college. And so that's really a key take-home point as well.
And I think a big issue to face, and I can't remember where I saw it, a study coming out about the underlying biases of our patient populations when it comes to female physicians and ethnic or different races in the female physicians, the challenges that you face just because of those things that underlie our entire culture.
Absolutely. And that's another really good point, Ryan, because bias goes both ways. So we as the provider certainly have our own implicit and explicit biases, but patients do as well. And so it's a back and forth dynamic that is important to be aware of. It's important to know what's happening. Implicit bias is essentially the behaviors and attitudes that we hold that oftentimes are associated with less than positive connotations about someone. They tend to be really subtle oftentimes, and they're all influenced by, again, just our daily interaction with television and media and what we see and what we've learned from childhood even. And so a lot of it's very much ingrained, and again, that's why a big part of this is going to be first and foremost awareness. What we do know is that while implicit bias is not at all intentional or conscious in many aspects, but it does tend to have bad effects when it comes to being able to develop a positive and healthy relationship with our patients and take care of them adequately. Studies have certainly shown that in terms of implicit bias as well as diversity, a patient feels more comfortable oftentimes with a provider with whom they feel that they can more closely relate if they have some things in common with that provider. And that also the patients as well as the provider certainly feel the effects of implicit bias.
I think there's a lot of this got thrust up into the forefront the last year with the studies that came out showing that female physicians have better outcomes than male physicians. And, you know, seeing that go up on the pages and then the back and forth, you know, the battle of the sexes back and forth with that. And, you know, and I think there's a lot of theories as to why female physicians from across the board basically get better results, better outcomes, and things like that. But I think that's now we're starting to see it thrust into the forefront more often, and I think we really need to look into what we do as physicians, what we do for our patients, and how the different, you know, male, female, race, ethnicity, how we can use that to strengthen our practices as opposed to what we've done in the past, which has been basically, you know, trying to add in diversity to a male Caucasian practice.
Absolutely. And, you know, diversity is such a broad term. When we say diversity, we're talking not just about gender, not just about race and ethnicity, but we're talking about age, diversity of age. We're talking about religious preferences and sexual orientation and even practice type, I would say, in terms of urban versus academics versus community. What we know is that when we develop a boiling pot that is truly diverse in all of those ways, we're going to optimize the work that we do.
You guys are putting together some education. You know, got a webinar coming up. So tell us more about some of these things to help. Now that we're kind of got this internal aspect of project going on with the committees and efforts, how we're now going to move that outside and help educate other physicians in the public.
Absolutely. So we're really excited about some upcoming work that we are going to produce. So as a task force, one of the tactics that we've employed to accomplish our objectives, one of which is engaging the specialty of emergency medicine and educating the specialty of emergency medicine, is creating webinars that teach about implicit bias as well as cultural competence. And so we're actually in the process of creating a really interactive, super engaging, static webinar that will also have a chat feature and will live online via ASEP. And we're hoping to actually launch the first segment of that webinar around ASEP 17 in October.
Give us an idea. So you mentioned that one of those is the implicit bias. Dig down into that a little bit more and to what that means for physicians. I mean, you've talked about a little bit at the beginning, but give us an idea of why that's, what about it has got that much education tied to it?
Well, there's certainly a lot of science behind implicit bias. It's been studied for years, and it's just now, I think, more than ever, the concept is being discussed more and more. But again, bias is the behaviors and the attitudes that we hold, oftentimes based on stereotypes or experiences that we've encountered over the course of our life, that associate something negative with someone without any real basis. And so what we know is that explicit bias is when we kind of consciously have these thoughts and we're aware of it. But implicit bias is a little trickier because we're not even aware of what we're doing. We're not aware of the fact that when we walk into a room, for example, to see a patient, we've already formed in our minds in some instances thoughts about that individual without really having a fair idea of who they are and why they're there. And it certainly comes into play every single day in our practice. And it's important that we're aware of it so that we can really take care of patients in a quality manner.
It's, you know, it's kind of the whole argument of, you know, you walk down the street and, you know, they followed people along, and certain people you walk up to, you walk across the street, or you move over on the sidewalk, or others you don't. I think it's hard. I think it's understanding those implicit biases. And I think, you know, as emergency medicine, I feel like that most of us feel like we're pretty free of a lot of that stuff because we treat anybody, anytime, anywhere.
Right.
24/7, 365. And, but at the same time, I definitely can see it. You know, when I see a chief complaint and an age pop up, it automatically gives me a picture. You know, when I see the 24-year-old who comes in with low back pain, chronic low back pain, my automatic assumption is going to be pill-seeking.
Sure.
You know, behaviors. So why is that, you know, I mean, some of that having that, so there's some important aspects of instinct when it comes to, you know, 85-year-old with back pain, I'm automatically going to think, rule out AAA.
Sure.
Or 55-year-old male diabetic with chest pain, I'm automatically going to, as opposed to an 18-year-old healthy person with chest pain. So some of these, some bias or instinct is important and in positive, but then what we're also talking about is the potential for that to for us to automatically paint somebody into a corner that may take our eye off the actual ball and what's important. So kind of break down some of that, how some of these biases are going to potentially hurt our patients and hurt our careers.
Absolutely. So there have been studies done that have irrefutably shown that when it comes to chest pain, for example, our management of chest pain amongst patients of color tends to be disparate. So when you match patients for socioeconomic status, for their chief complaint and their vital signs, and you get rid of all the confounders, the outcomes still have been found to be different in terms of what the management is. And so in other words, some studies have shown that, for example, patients of color are going to be less likely to go to the cath lab, for example, or to have an intervention done to treat acute coronary syndrome. Similarly, when it comes to breast cancer, for women of color with breast cancer, the outcomes are, again, irrefutably and kind of inexplicably disparate. When you, again, match for all of those descriptors, when compare a Caucasian female to an African-American female, breast cancer, same type of breast cancer, same staging, et cetera, the outcomes still tend to be disparate, such that African-American women have much higher morbidity as well as mortality. And so you have to think about that, and we have to kind of try to get our arms around that and ask ourselves, why is that? Why is that? What is happening? Are there some subtle differences in how we're treating certain patients? And are there differences that we are employing when we're taking care of patients and assuming things, making assumptions, etc.? And a lot of it is just really, it flies under the radar. Again, the word we're using here is implicit. So these are not always conscious thoughts.
That is hard. And, you know, when you see that stuff, the automatic argument that pops up is, oh, it's an access issue. It's, the Caucasian population tends to have better access to care, you know. Whereas minorities, especially African Americans, tend to be inner city, less access to care, less seeking care, less trustful of care. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like it's that easy. I mean, if we're taking out all of these variables, there's still something inside the physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners that is different in the care that we're providing.
Exactly.
Where do we go from here?
Well, we are going to continue to work really hard around the initiatives in this task force around diversity and inclusion. We've been actually working really hard now for several months to at least begin to scratch the surface when it comes to enlightening us as a college and as a specialty around the topic of diversity, inclusion, and implicit bias and cultural competence. So we hope to continue to provide the college with the resources and tools that we need to optimize our management of patients by being aware of these really important issues. One thing that I definitely want everyone to do is to look forward to our upcoming webinar that we're planning to launch around October, around ASAP 17. I am certain that you're going to enjoy that, learn a lot, and be enlightened. We have within the college several extremely bright individuals who actually spend much of their time studying these issues and topics. And so there's tons of expertise actually on the task force who will be involved with the creation of this webinar. And so I would say that I want everyone to look forward to checking it out when it's released in October.
I want to dig a little bit, just really quickly. You mentioned the cultural competence. And speaking of competence, define a little bit better what you're talking about with that cultural competence and how that plays into our practice of medicine.
Sure. So to be culturally competent is to be aware of differences amongst patients, in this instance, that are influenced by their particular culture. And so, for example, we know that different types of groups of people communicate differently in terms of how, if they're having pain, they may communicate that differently than other groups. And so to be aware of that difference is important, because we don't want to assume that someone is not in pain just because they're not being emotional about it or visually showing that they're in pain. There are cultures that are that tend to just be more stoic in terms of their presentation, and so it's really important to be aware of that. Also, another example has to do with just understanding various skin types in terms of skin color. You know, how many times have you gone in to see a patient who may have darker colored skin and they're like, I have a rash on my arm. And you're like, I don't see a rash. Where's the rash? Something as simple as that really speaks to cultural competence. It speaks to being aware of the possibility that you could be missing something if you don't step back for a moment and really view the patient as a whole and be thoughtful around those issues.
It's huge with when it comes to, I think that cultural competence is a huge contributor in each area, and each ER is going to be a little bit different. So Lexington, we have a large Hispanic Latin American population because of the horse industry. In fact, you know, there's the breakdown of percentages. It's, you know, a city where Hispanic population is the majority minority. Mm. And so, you know, it's very different. Also, a lot of refugees, Congolese refugees. You know, so it is very different, and that is something you have to understand. It's not taught in as much in medical schools and residencies and things like that, as how life experience and where you come from not only dictates how you experience symptoms, but express them and communicate them. And that was one of the hardest things after a miss in residency. You know, potentially dangerous miss in residency, of understanding that difference in communication. Maybe as simple as, you know, how an adult Hispanic male describes abdominal pain. You know, whereas I'm looking for that easy to identify right lower quadrant abdominal pain, those key words that we look for. You know, it may explain it very differently and still be appendicitis. And so I think that's something that's going to be integral to understand, not only from the way you communicate, but also accurate diagnosis and treatment of these patients.
It's an extremely big deal to be able to communicate effectively with patients. We know that 70% of diagnoses are made based on just the history. Mm-hmm. So if we're not able to take an accurate and effective history, if we're not able to understand what our patients are trying to relay in their own unique ways, then we're failing our patient population.
How can folks get in touch with you?
I am right here in D.C. You can find me at George Washington University. I'm online as well. You can always email me at asia.t.liferidge@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to anyone further about this really important topic. I appreciate the opportunity.
Are you on the social web?
Yes, I am.
Twitter?
I am.
What's your Twitter handle?
That's a good question. I do have an account.
That's a lot. I hear a lot in ASAP. You know, it's the difference between I get the smack and like everybody's got it, and I got a, you know, there's not only here's my Twitter account, but also here's my emoticon and all these other things around social media. And a lot of people with ASAP, yeah, I've got an account, I think. And I don't know exactly what it is. So, but you can feel free to contact me, like our Facebook page, the ASAP Frontline page, as well as at Everyday Med on Twitter. And you can always contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.